Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Supernatural George. I'm Mittens, and today we're going to be talking about Season 8, Episode 2, What's Up, Tiger Mommy? Written by Andrew Dabb and Daniel Laughlin, and it's the last episode that they will write together as a team. They've been writing as a team together since 4-6 Yellow Fever. And it's directed by John F. Showalter. There's just so much going on in this episode. Dean is really struggling adapting back to normal life outside of the constant combat of purgatory. Like a soldier returning to civilian life after a year on the front lines in constant battle, and a hell of a lot of baggage that's still too painful to deal with. We also see how his reunion with Cass in purgatory went. We also meet Samandriel, aka Alfie, heaven's most adorable angel in a Wiener Hut uniform. And I'll speculate about how this might be exactly how Heaven learned what happened to Cass, and how that portal worked, and Cass's personal motivations for staying behind in purgatory. It's all just so heartbreaking. My notes here say, cough, Destiel, cough, but, yeah, basically. Also, there's the fact that people Dean doesn't need anymore tend to end up dead. Big guilt trip time for Dean. We meet Plutus, the god of greed, and witness his auction where he apparently just steals things to sell them back to the people he stole them from. What a scam. And we learn that Sam is perfectly capable of wielding Mjolnir, and then whine for a minute about how we'll never see the hammer again, because if I was Sam, I would have kept that thing forever and used it all the time. But, you know, he doesn't. Plus, poor Kevin, poor Mrs. Tran. There's two very short scenes that are cut from this episode, but that are on the DVD if you have it. Otherwise, the descriptions of the missing scenes are on the Super Wiki, where you can read them for yourselves if you choose. In one, Dean complains about wearing a suit, which feels weird knowing that Dean likes to look good now, and he knows how to fit in, and he knows that wearing that suit helps him fit in when working cases. But it underscores just how poorly he's reintegrating back into regular life. And I mean, he wore a suit without complaint in last week's episode, so having him complain about it now just feels one episode too late for that conversation to happen anyway. But I get what they were going for when they shot it, and I understand why it was cut as well. So he's struggling with being normal citizen guy who has to follow social rules and things. His people skills are rusty, if you will. The other cutscene is a one-liner from Mrs. Tran as they leave the pawn shop after she handily wins the battle of wits against the owner and gets the information they needed. She says to Dean, "Queen takes pawn," and drops the pawn slip in his hand. And again, it's a great line, but if they needed to make up some time for other scenes, I kind of understand why this particular one was cut. We already saw her masterfully take that guy down. Her little coup de grace there at the end. I like it. I'm glad they included it on the DVD. And with so much to get through in this episode, let's just get on with it. To the then segment, which is mostly revealed through intercut scenes of Dean and Sam's first conversation from last week's episode. We open with a montage about Dean's return from purgatory and quick cuts of what happened there, and his reunion with Sam afterward, which is apparently the first time that Sam learns that Dean spent the whole year in purgatory. How he never even guessed that after a whole year kind of boggles the mind, but nobody ever said Sam was the smart one. Oh, wait. We see scenes of the violence that Dean endured in purgatory, and his meeting with Benny, who mysteriously was apparently the only person in purgatory who knew about the human portal that would send people back to Earth, and how it worked. Dean also tells Sam that Cass didn't make it and refuses to explain or clarify what that meant. We're then reminded about Kevin Tran, Prophet of the Lord, and Dean's anger at Sam for abandoning his responsibility to Kevin and refusing to even answer the phone for a year. When they finally found Kevin last week, Crowley killed his girlfriend, and we learn how Kevin escaped from Crowley by making a demon bomb, which he learned translating the demon tablet, because that's a thing that exists now, and also has a spell to banish all demons from Earth and lock the gates of hell forever. So of course doing that is now priority number one for all of them. And that brings us to now. In Chicago, Illinois, at a bank where the teller is showing an old man to his safe deposit box. Box number one. Inside, he finds a creepy glowing bone and then kills the bank teller for good measure. And then we cut to the title card. Post-title card, Dean is once again enjoying an alfresco cheeseburger. The close-up shot of his hands holding it, he's just so freckly. Even the backs of his hands are all freckly. Other than my personal enjoyment of this fact, we should probably move on here. Kevin is pleading his case for wanting to go check on his mom, but it's a day's drive in the other direction from where they are currently, and Dean's trying to discourage that plan. But Kevin will not be dissuaded. He's furious that his girlfriend was killed, and he wants to make sure that his mother is safe. Dean gruffly tries to convince Kevin that his mom is fine, with frankly unassailable logic, that Crowley needs her to be fine. She's probably surrounded by demon bodyguards, waiting to snatch up Kevin the minute he shows his face there. Dean argues that the safer plan is to get the tablet, whip up the hell-slamming spell, and get rid of all the demons first, as if that was going to be a simple task and not a massive shift in the natural order requiring a ridiculous amount of sacrifice to pull off. Because Dean just doesn't have any of those facts yet. But we do have those facts, because we know what this is going to entail. And it's going to be terrible for everybody. Kevin argues back that the thought of his mom surrounded by demon guards is exactly why he needs to check on her first. And Dean caves. They at least do the smart thing and quietly stake out Kevin's house in neighbor Michigan. Again, a town that doesn't exist in our universe. And Kevin sees her, and she seems sad, but okay. Dean hadn't been looking at Linda, though, but everyone else around her house. They're all demons. So they covertly lure off the demon gardener and the demon mailman and kill them before letting Kevin go home. R.I.P. to Carl the mailman. Mrs. Tran is confused when Dean splashes holy water all over her, but her friend Eunice tries to smoke out. She is a demon. And Sam stops the demon from leaving with a reverse exorcism. And then Dean kills her with the demon knife. R.I.P. Eunice. Note that they have zero hesitation about killing demon-possessed people anymore. I know this has been an issue in fandom, and I've talked about it before, but I'll remind folks again of my personal feelings about it. I don't find it strange or upsetting, because outside of Sam's demon-possessed people, he was baited into exorcising with his demon blood powers. Very few possessed people actually survive possession anyway. And in this specific case, if they allowed these demons to return to Crowley to report in on Kevin's movements, that would put them all in danger. Later on, I think it's important to point out that Dean killed these demons with zero hesitation here. And Kevin doesn't even make any sign of protest at all, even though they're killing a guy that he actually knows by name, Carl the mailman. Kevin complains not one whit about killing these demons and even his mom's friend Eunice. He understands the practicality of it. Later on this episode, when Dean does hesitate because the demon is Kevin's mother, Kevin's going to be friggin' furious that Dean was even remotely considering killing her, even though she was possessed by a demon that was trying to capture and abuse and do horrific things to Kevin. So there's no logic to it. It's all this gut emotional reaction. Because if it had been anyone other than his own mother, Kevin would not have hesitated for one second. He would not have thought twice about that person. But it is his mother, and that is why Dean hesitates. And it doesn't do anything to Dean's self-esteem to think about it. But we'll get to that later. They explain all of this to Linda and their plan to lock all demons away forever so that this cannot happen to anyone else. And it will protect Kevin long term. She very practically accepts all of this and instantly shifts from her ambition for Kevin to succeed in the world into helping him be the best prophet of the Lord that he can be. Sam and Dean plan to take Mrs. Tran to a safe house, one that Crowley won't know about, while they retrieve the tablet. But Linda refuses to leave Kevin unprotected and insists on going with them. What Sam tells her is scarily portentous, like so many other things in this episode. Crowley, he is not just a killer. He trades in torment, and if he can find a way to separate your soul from you, he'll take that soul to hell and he'll roast it till there's nothing left but black smoke. Because Crowley will attempt to divide them from their souls, not just in the very literal sense of removing their souls, but he's going to try and keep all of them individually not working together by the end of this episode. He's a divide and conquer kind of guy. And he plays that card very, very, very effectively in this episode. Linda's reply, though, she's not worried about her own soul. Only Kevin, because she will absolutely prove that by the end of this episode, too. Dean looks to Kevin to help explain to her why this is a terrible idea, but Kevin says that he can't tell her what to do. Linda stands firm, even though she has absolutely no idea what she's walking into. Dean explains what they'll need for her to join them. Hex bags to hide their location, and anti-possession tattoos. Linda is completely fine with this. It's not even her first tattoo, which kind of surprises everyone. Dean's quietly pleased about it. And I love the musical choice here of the Reverend Horton Heat, while Linda sits stoically and Kevin squirms and writhes in agony while getting their tattoos. But I have no idea why, outside of stupid plot reasons, why did they let them get these tattoos on their arms instead of somewhere under their clothes? Like, there's a reason you hide anti-possession tattoos, so that demons can't see them, and they're harder to access. I get that Linda's tattoo needs to be compromised by the end of the episode, and we all then need to be able to see that. But it still bugs me that they didn't insist on the tattoo going under their clothes, or at least try to insist on it. Dean and Sam wait by the window while they get tattooed, and Dean continues to be excited by the fact that they seem so close to solving all of their problems forever and slamming hell shut. Poor Dean has no idea yet. And then he asks how Sam did the reverse exorcism on Eunice. Sam just said the verse backward and hoped it would work, and luckily for him, it did. After they're safely tattooed, they head to a bus station in Laramie, Wyoming, and open the locker that Kevin hid the tablet in. But the tablet's gone. The thief was the former security guard at the station, who'd been robbing random lockers, Clem Smedley, who was arrested the day before. And that name just makes him sound like a cartoon character, Clem Smedley. So Sam and Dean go to interview him, ask him about the tablet, and dumb old Clem tries to lawyer up. Sam is making little headway, but something he says about working out a little something-something with the locals if he cooperates, sends Dean reeling into a purgatory flashback where he and Benny are interrogating a monster. Where's the angel? That's all Dean wants to know. And Dean is convinced that the monster they're interrogating knows. In the present, Clem's rambling on about full immunity if he cooperates, and Dean's shifted into purgatory mode, pulling off his tie and stalking around Clem like a predator. He knows this guy has the info they need. He wraps the tie around Clem's neck from behind, pulls him out of his chair and slams him against the wall, and then pulls out the demon knife to hold to his throat, as if this was a perfectly rational thing to do. But I mean, it's how he did things in purgatory. And clearly Dean is not transitioning back to normal life very well. The present scene is intercut with him interrogating the monster in purgatory in a very similar way to how he's interrogating Clem, while Sam protests. The monster does tell them where he'd seen the angel, while Benny calmly watches on, just observing how Dean interrogates this guy. And Clem tells them that he sold everything to a pawn shop, while Sam tries to stop Dean from behaving in this fashion. In purgatory, Dean then killed the monster after he got the information he needed, but in the present, he just lets Clem go and walks away. So he's not completely reverting to purgatory feral, but he still knows there are some lines he cannot cross anymore, and he's trying to stay on this side of those lines. There's a shiny red Ferrari parked outside the pawn shop that Kevin admires, and Linda keeps him from getting distracted by it. Inside, the shop owner doesn't want to be helpful. Dean tries to threaten the guy, but the guy is confident that Dean won't beat him down with the security cameras recording everything. So Linda steps up and asks about the Ferrari. He insults her, and Dean tries to step in to defend her, but she holds him off and confidently walks up to the counter. She's turned on professional smart lady mode, and this dude is shook. She noticed the car's expired tags, which means he hasn't registered the car yet, probably because he hasn't paid the taxes on it. She knows the year, make, and model of the car from just walking past it, turns to Kevin and asks what the average Blue Book value on it is, and he just knows off the top of his head like he memorized the entire Blue Book. Because if he actually can do that, I really want Kevin on my pub trivia team, because that is insane. Just to be able to memorize that much raw information. Not that we have trivia about cars by make and model, but like just to be able to memorize lists of information like that. Insane. Anyway, that's totally not the point. Linda's also impressed that Sam instantly calculates what the 5% Wyoming tax would be on that amount. The clerk is nervous now, looking down a $10,000 tax bill, and Linda says that her brother works for the Wyoming Tax Assessor's Office and would be happy to come do an audit, which is motivating enough for Lyle the pawn shop dude to cooperate. And what is with the cartoon names in this episode? Dab has a fetish. And once again, Dean is delighted and impressed by Linda. Anyway, they get the info on the person Lyle sold the tablet to and find themselves at a random motel where they're approached by a smarmy, fancy-looking chap who knows exactly who they are. He has an invitation for them to a special auction where they'll be selling the Word of God. And this guy, Bo, works for Plutus, the god of greed. He insists that the auction is securely warded and the safest place that they could possibly bring the profit to. He even mentions specifically that the whole place will be warded, that nobody's going to be able to magically throw them up against a wall. Dean and Sam are unconvinced and unimpressed. And after he leaves, after giving them their invitation, I kind of love that Dean calls the guy Mr. Peanut. When Bo flaps off, They debate how they'll be able to afford to pay for the tablet at an auction. All they have is a couple of hacked gold cards. And then Sam turns to the Impala and is about to suggest selling the car. And Dean puts his foot down and says not to even consider it, or he'll kill Sam, his kids, and his grandkids. Dean doesn't even hesitate about making that threat. Sam then suggests they just show up to the auction early while the items are all out on display, and Kevin could just read the tablet and memorize the spell, because we all know he's good at memorizing stuff from the Blue Book scene. Linda is absolutely confident in the fact that, yes, Kevin can 100% do that. Dean then turns to the Impala and grumbles, "He didn't mean it, baby." And Sam gives Dean a look like, "Oh, Dean, get over it." The auction is happening in a warehouse covered in spray-painted sigils. Kevin, Linda, and Sam all pass through the metal detector without issue, but Dean covers his crotch like that will protect him from radiation or something, and then he sets the machine off anyway. He's forced to empty his pockets, and we get a shot of a box absolutely filled with a wide variety of weapons, including a ninja star, Dean's favorite Colt 1911, and he warns Bo that he will be back for his demon knife before adding it to the box. Like, you're not putting this thing up for auction. He gets how this guy operates. Inside the auction room, a wide variety of objects are on display, including the sword Excalibur, which we know from season 6 is actually capable of slaying dragons. That would honestly have been a handy thing for them to keep in the aftermath of this auction. And Mr. Villy, brother of Odin from the cold open, is examining Mjolnir. And yes, that is who Mr. Villy is. Villy, the god, is one of Odin's two brothers in Norse mythology. So that is his connection to Mjolnir, if you didn't know that. Unfortunately, when they arrive at the demon tablet, it's covered by panels on both sides, so Kevin can't even read it. And that's when Crowley shows up. He can't believe they'd bring the prophet to the, quote, most dangerous place on earth, after they were assured by Bo that it would be actually the safest place on earth for him. Strangely, I'd rather trust Crowley's assessment on this one, all things considered, since Crowley is what makes it the most dangerous place on earth for Kevin. Linda stands in front of Kevin as Crowley strolls over, giving a not at all sorry apology about what he did to Channing. When Crowley tries to schmooze Linda, soften her up, Linda just punches him in the face. And then the rest of us cheered. But Crowley's new personal goal is torturing Linda now. And oh boy, again, by the end of this episode, he's going to get his wish. Dean steps up like he's willing to fight Crowley too, but Crowley points out that they'll be thrown out of the auction if they cause a scene, and Dean backs off. But the auction is about to start, and while Sam compliments Linda's right hook and they walk into the auction room, Dean is approached by Samandriel, the angel of Wiener Hut. Dean chooses to call him Alfie instead of Samandriel, so I will too. It's easier. He's apparently not used to being in a vessel, but angels feel responsible to protect the word of God, so there he is, ready to bid on it. But Alfie pulled Dean aside to ask him about what happened to Cass. Apparently Heaven doesn't know yet. Dean explains quickly that they were in purgatory, and Alfie says even some of the angels still believe that Cass had good intentions, despite what happened with the Leviathan. Alfie mentions his heart a couple of times during this little interaction, that it was always in the right place, and then when Dean asks if Alfie was one of the angels that believed that, Alfie gives us the famous, "I think too much heart was always Castiel's problem." And Alfie does seem genuinely sad that Cass didn't escape purgatory, but that line also feels like a bit of a judgment of Cass on his part, you know, that this was a weakness that Cass had and he wouldn't have succumbed to it if he hadn't been weak in this particular area. And I've never really seen Alfie as like a true Cass devotee ally type character because of this. He's just one more bureaucrat angel who was playing politics here, who thinks that Cass screwed up. He won't speak ill of the dead, as it were. Anyway, I need to stop here for another second, because I know this is one of those lines that people take as concrete canon proof that Cass truly always had been this rebellious special angel who always felt things more deeply and cared more than other angels. And yes, combined with the crack in his chassis and never really obeyed lines that we get from Naomi later this season, it doesn't seem unreasonable to infer this, but I just can't. Not after everything we've seen to this point. His struggle to understand humanity in season 4, with Anna prompting him to understand for himself. If he really was always the lone special rebel, then why was it Anna who fell first? And why would her choice prompt revulsion in Cass? Even Hester in season 7 was outraged at what Cass did, accusing Dean of having been the one to have corrupted Cass at all. Every season afterward, the angel population shrinks. The frontline guardians of Earth are largely gone, Cass's whole garrison. Or at least, they're dwindling rapidly. And what's left are the bureaucrats from heaven, who never had dealings with humans outside of monitoring heaven's soul cells and feeling superior about themselves. I honestly don't know that Cass really was much of an outlier compared to the rest of his garrison, for example, until after he pulled Dean from hell and began to get a more human perspective on things. Sure, he protested what they were ordered to do to the firstborns, but that is literally the only example we have in canon of Cass truly rebelling in any way prior to the start of canon, and not wanting to slaughter an entire generation of innocent babies in the name of God is the entirely reasonable conclusion to draw here. I'm with Cass. But it wasn't the grand display of, quote, too much heart that Alfie seemed to accuse Cass of, and I've never personally read it as such. To me, doing that takes away the core of what actually makes Cass's entire narrative arc so special, to imply that he always had some latent enhanced capability for love as humans understand it. He was obviously open to it, and not so dead set in the rule of heaven to consider it, but it's literally his personal journey through canon that develops it into what we see by the end of the series. And then he was still left hanging. But I am not going to yell about the series finale yet again. Just know that I'm screaming inside my heart about it. Okay, enough of that tangent. Back to the show. When Alfie walks away, Dean has another flashback to Purgatory, to the side of a stream where he finally found Cass. He's filthy and trying to wash up in a stream, and his beard is growing for the first time ever. We've never seen him look anything less than perfectly clean-shaven, as if angels just didn't grow hair normally if they didn't want to. And we know he could have just snapped himself clean if he wanted. But he's resorted to doing things in a more human way already, as if it was part of the penance that he's putting himself through. Dean calls out to him, and Cass frantically looks around like he's worried Leviathans will catch up to them, with Dean standing right there now. But Dean is nothing but delighted to have found him. He strolls right up, grinning, and gives Cass a big hug, while Cass just stands there. And we get camera angles from both sides of this hug. Dean's face looks relieved and overjoyed to finally have Cass back. And Cass, from his side, we get a hand clench. And I didn't even notice it the first time I watched this through, but then I notice it every single time now. As Dean holds him and Cass just stands there stiffly, he squeezes his fist. Like, he's doing everything in his power to not let himself enjoy this, to not be relieved that Dean is there so happy to see him, because he can't let himself be happy about that. He's got a mission that he's on to save Dean, to protect Dean, to not put Dean directly in danger. And being with him right now puts Dean in danger. When Dean pulls back to look him over, playfully touching his beard, commenting on the peach fuzz, Cass taking it as a compliment but looking real shifty, and then Dean introduces him to Benny. Cass just looks panicked, asks how Dean found him. Dean only wants to know how Cass is. Not crazy, apparently, but 94% of psychotics don't think they're crazy, so what is sanity even? Dean's trying to just go with the flow of this conversation, and Benny just doesn't have any patience for it, butts in to grill Cass about why he bailed on Dean. Dean cuts Benny off to defend Cass. He assumes that Cass must have been jumped by some creature that dragged him away, and then Cass fought him off. Dean has already been self-editing what happened so that he wouldn't have to admit to himself that Cass probably just wanted to get away from him. And Cass tells him, no, yeah, I ran away. And Dean's entire demeanor turns on a dime. He's angry that Cass could have left him because he prayed to Cass every night. And yeah, Cass knew that too. He heard all those prayers and did nothing, but probably felt like complete shit about it anyway, because he completely believed that he was doing the right thing, because Dean may have been fighting monsters at every turn, but the Leviathan have been after Cass since they landed in Purgatory, and Cass could not risk the Leviathan catching up with them if he stayed with Dean. He would not put Dean in the bullseye like that. Cass may have accepted the price on his own head, but he would not be responsible for Dean getting killed for his own actions, you know? Cass tells Dean to leave him, and Benny thinks that's a great idea, but Dean tries to tell Cass the plan, that they have a way home. Cass says he can't. He's definitely still operating under a pall of guilt and feels he deserves the punishment of being in Purgatory. He does not think he deserves to be saved, if you will. Dean tells Benny to explain their plan, and Benny does, and then adds the bit that he doesn't know if an angel can get through that portal or not. Note, please, that there is zero certainty about that fact here, even if it's later presented as if it was a concrete fact. Benny has no idea if Cass can get through that portal, but he doesn't care, because his job is to get Dean through it. If Cass gets through it or not, you know, Benny sees Cass as a liability from the start, and he will say or do anything to dissuade Cass from sticking around with them. Except there's a problem. Dean won't go without him. Dean makes his grand plea to Cass, tells him he needs him. An important phrase later in this episode, because people Dean doesn't need anymore tend to die bloody. And that's what he's convinced himself must have happened to Cass. And he blames himself so he can turn around and blame himself for it. But he tells Cass that they beat the Leviathan once and they can do it again if they stick together. When Cass still tries to protest, Dean gives him the bottom line ultimatum. He's not leaving without Cass. And Cass knows that Dean means that completely. Cass's only mission now is making sure that Dean gets back through that portal, one way or another, whatever it takes. Then Cass can just hang around and be Leviathan bait for the rest of eternity, I suppose. Back in the present, the auction comes to order. Crowley says hi to Samandriel, obviously recognizes him, which is kind of interesting. Our intrepid bidders pull out their wallets and pool their cash, while Crowley mutters behind them about how the tablet's not that useful to them. They can blast a few of his demons, but he'll just make more. And they can't get rid of all the demons. And Sam takes the bait and mutters back, "We'll see about that." So Crowley now has an idea of what the stakes in this game might actually be. Up to this point, he had no idea there was a slam hell shut forever play on that tablet. But now he has a 100% more intense interest on getting that tablet away from the Winchesters and doing everything in his power to prevent them from ever learning the contents of that tablet. Their pooled funds are only a couple of hacked credit cards, $2,000 in cash, and a Costco membership card that Linda contributed and seems to think adds real value to the fund. But the first item up for bid opens at 3 tons of dwarven gold, and they all realize just how screwed they are. And Crowley looks smugly delighted. Dean excuses himself to use the restroom and sees an employee out in the gallery room collecting all the items to be bid on. He follows the man to a vault room, hides, and waits, and then pickpockets the key off the guy and tries to break in and steal the tablet. Unfortunately, there's 2 more guards inside the vault, and Dean laughs it off with, "Oh, this isn't the men's room." And then luckily, they don't try and kill him on the spot. But he does get a glimpse of the tablet before going back to the auction. He knows it's in there. Back at the auction, we see Mr. Veeley bidding his finger bone from the frost giant Ymir, along with 5/8 of a virgin, which wins him Thor's hammer Mjolnir. Poor bank teller lady is now just the contents of a bloody sack, or at least 5/8 of her is. When Dean sits back down beside Sam and tells him Plan C tanked, Crowley suggests they try Plan D for dumbass. The next item up for bid is the tablet, though, and Crowley's opening bid is $3 billion. Obviously, our heroes can't bid against that, but more than that, Dean and Sam are both kind of blown away that Crowley has that kind of money to bid in the first place. Alfie stands up and bids the Mona Lisa, which also garners looks of shock from our boys. Crowley counters with the real Mona Lisa, where she's topless. Alfie counters with all of Vatican City, which is a really big deal. Gets more looks from Sam and Dean. And then Crowley counters that with Alaska. When Bo declines that offer, Crowley bids the moon, which finally earns a baffled comment from Dean. Of course Crowley claimed the moon for hell. How else does a guy named Buzz get to walk on the moon without making a deal? But Bo is unsatisfied with even that bid, and to sweeten the deal, in addition to the tablet, he includes Kevin Tran, Prophet of the Lord, and the only person on Earth who can actually read the tablet. Kevin is zapped up to the front of the room, chained to a grate. Linda jumps to her feet, but when Sam and Dean try to stand as well, a guard pushes them back down. Linda stops the bidding, says she'll give them whatever they want. She offers her retirement savings, her house, and is told that this is out of her price range. She only wrestles with the decision for a moment and then bids her soul. Kevin tries to stop her. Even Dean questions her on it. Just like she said at the beginning of the episode, she's not worried about her own soul. Only her son's. And I really wish she'd been even a skosh more worried about her own soul here. But Crowley perks up at this. If they want souls, Crowley can give them 1,000,000 souls. He's experienced in soul trading after all. Remember season 6? And he is just that desperate for this tablet and Kevin. Dean turns to Alfie and asks if he's going to counter that offer. But Alfie is firm that they guard the souls in heaven. They don't horse trade them. Which I honestly do appreciate, even from a bureaucrat angel. At least he knows where the power of heaven comes from, you know? You don't trade that away. But Plutus tells Crowley that it's not about the quantity of souls, but the sacrifice behind giving it up. and Linda's single soul is the most valuable thing she has in the world. It's everything to her, and it's a much larger sacrifice for her to give it up than what Crowley is offering. Is Crowley offering to give up everything that he has? He hesitates for a moment and then offers his own soul. Plutus laughs at him and tells him, "Mr. Crowley, you don't have a soul." And once again, fandom sometimes interprets this to mean that demons don't have souls. And that notion just doesn't sit right with me, because demons are twisted human souls. That's all they are. Get rid of the soul and there's literally nothing left of them. So his soul might be corrupted, but that's also literally all he is. Of course Plutus couldn't accept it, and he just laughed. Because the joke is actually a reference to the real life in our universe, Aleister Crowley. And I've been searching for the quote for years and can't for the life of me remember where I first read it, probably 30 or 35 years ago, at least. But it was a line that was nearly identical to this one. And it was either said to or about Aleister Crowley. So when I showed up in this fandom and heard that line, I laughed too. Until I saw folks trying to use it as some definitive statement on demons. And I just can't see it that way. I can't see past the pointed reference to Aleister Crowley in our universe, who obviously Crowley is named after. Anyway, besides the point. But Linda has won the auction, and Crowley storms off in search of his own plan B. Later, Sam and Dean sit with Linda in the empty auction room. She worries about whether losing her soul will hurt, and Dean says, probably yes. She asks if she'll die, and Sam tells her very bluntly, no, she'll just wish she was dead. And yeah, that comes from very scarring personal experience. Poor Linda is tearing up and asks for a minute alone. As they walk away, Sam comments on how much this whole situation sucks, but Dean is already focused on their prize, as if it's a foregone conclusion now. He's already single-track barreling toward the solution to every problem he thinks he's ever had in his entire life. Since demons killed his mother and tried to use his brother when he was 4 years old. This is the one sort of situation where all of Dean's instincts get shut down in pursuit of the dangerous bigger picture, because he never has the entire bigger picture yet when he goes off like this. Just like he won't when he says yes to the Mark of Cain, or to alternate universe Michael, or to killing Jack, or to the big stupid plan to kill Chuck in the end that Chuck absolutely relied on for his larger plan to work. This is Dean's true Achilles heel. The promise of having his problems solved permanently and getting full control over his own life. Finally, at long last, after 4 decades plus of suffering. He says to Sam that if this is all it costs them to shut hell forever, to theoretically solve every problem they've ever had all at once, then they got off cheap. And this strikes me as an insane amount of hubris. I can hear the Kill Bill sirens going off, even if they're not playing actively in the series here. Because we all know what hell they're about to put themselves through, even if they're still blissfully ignorant. When they're gone, though, Samandriel begins to introduce himself to Linda and then course corrects and sticks with the name Alfie. He tells her he's an angel, and she's confused why an angel works at Wiener Hut. He just sort of glosses over the whole how angel vessels thing works and gets to the point. He offers for the angels to protect Kevin because the Winchesters mean well, but they're only men. Linda cuts him off, reminding Alfie that she's already seen angels die before, and then Kevin went missing for a whole year. She wants to take her chances with Sam and Dean, and Alfie seems to respect this and walks out. and I always wondered if this was also when Crowley had him snatched up and imprisoned, you know? Because inside this building, Alfie is essentially powerless. It's all warded against him being able to use his powers. He could have been easily grabbed up at this point. It'll be a while before we see him again, but it does feel like him getting snatched here could be the reason why we don't see him for a while, even on the fringes and trying to watch out for Kevin. In the other room, Sam glares at Mr. Villi as he fawns over Mjolnir. A moment later, Bo leads Linda in. Dean demands to see Kevin, and he's brought in too. And Sam wants to know what Plutus will do with Linda's soul. He answers, "Whatever I want," and then goes creepy about it, like, "Oh yeah, she'll keep me warm at night." Like, "Oh, stop talking, you creep." He holds out his hands to her. She hesitates for a moment, but then raises her arm and walks toward him. But Dean stops her because he notices the huge burn mark on her arm where her anti-possession tattoo had been. Her eyes flash red, and she speaks in Crowley's voice before throwing Sam and Dean against opposite walls. Just the reminder that so much of this episode feels like a heck of a lot of dodgeballs of prophecy getting thrown around here, because the assurance Sam and Dean got from Bo about the auction was that there would be preventative measures against them being thrown up against walls, and yet here they are getting thrown up against walls. Plutus is confused. His warding spells should have prevented Crowley from using his powers, and Linda Crowley, or is it Crowley Linda? Whatever. He, she, whatever, says Bo showed him how to get around that, and Bo just shrugs. We get a flashback to exactly what happened right after Linda declined Simandriel's offer of protection. Bo slammed the door on her, told her that that was a stupid move, and then he burns the warding sigil off her arm. Back in the present, Crowley says it only cost him an island in the South Pacific. He considers it a bargain, probably especially since he'll never have to pay up on it after Bo gets hammered here in a second. But Bo has moved up behind Plutus and literally stabs him in the back. Crowley pulls the stake out of Plutus's chest as he falls dead and throws it through the security guard. Crowley might not have all of his powers, but he can do enough to take the tablet and run. Kevin yells for him to get out of his mother. Sam tackles Linda before she can leave with the tablet, and Dean manages to find the demon knife in a big box of his weapons. The two of them put themselves between Kevin and Crowley and dare him to try and take Kevin. Crowley decides he's pushed his luck about as far as it can go and makes a run for it with just the tablet. Sam stays behind to guard Kevin while Dean chases after Linda with the knife. Kevin warns Sam to duck as Bo tries to shoot him. Kevin then tries to make a run for it in the melee, but stops as Bo implies he'll trade Kevin to Crowley for another private island. Sam had been crouched in the corner beside Mr. Villi and Mjolnir and clearly talked him into using the weapon on Bo. One blow from the magic hammer reduces Bo to a sparkly poof and a pile of clothes, but it's too late to stop Kevin from chasing after Dean and Linda. When Mr. Villi asks for the hammer back, Sam considers it for a second and then asks him where he got the 5/8 of a virgin. Villi just shrugs, trying to look innocent, and Sam smites him with the hammer too, which lands on his now vacant pile of clothes. It still bugs me, and so many other people in fandom, that they didn't actually pick up the hammer again and take it with them. So many opportunities lost. Dean finally catches up with Linda, who drops the tablet as he pins her to a wall with the demon knife to her throat. As we've seen him do twice already in this episode, in Purgatory and then again in the interrogation room, she's managing to hold him off for just a few seconds, but Dean is distracted completely when Kevin runs in and shouts for his mom. Crowley takes the opportunity to flee her body and return to his own, and then he just strolls back into the room, picks up the tablet, and Dean just stands there instead of trying to kill him again. It's like he already knows he lost his chance. But while he was possessing Linda, Crowley learned a few things from reading her mind. He now knows what their big plan is, to close the gates of hell. He also claims to know who Kevin's real father is, and it's apparently scandalous. While Kevin's trying to comfort his mother, and Dean just stands there not doing anything useful, and who the heck knows where Sam is, Crowley gives Kevin a little advice. To run far away from the Winchesters, because they have a habit of using people up and then watching them die bloody. And then he disappears. And again, in fandom, I've heard this line used as a blanket statement of absolute truth, instead of a very pointedly manipulative thing said by one of the literal villains of the season. Crowley is not stupid, and now that he knows their plan, it is entirely in his own personal best interest to drive a wedge between the Winchesters and Kevin, to keep them all very far apart so they can't gang up on him together. It really feels like Crowley could have easily thrown Dean off when Dean first pinned him to the wall there. He could have chucked him against another wall, and absolutely did not need to stand there wrestling as Dean tried to stab him with the knife, 2 inches from Linda's throat, except to make sure that Kevin arrived in time to see him doing that. Because in Kevin's eyes, Dean wasn't trying to kill the demon possessing his mother. Dean was trying to kill his mother. So bravo to Crowley for orchestrating that divide. And Dean just stands there and watches Crowley leave. Linda's taking time to recover from her possession. She's not speaking, not responding really at all, just sitting there like a statue. Dean tries to reassure Kevin that she will recover. She's a strong woman. But Kevin doesn't want to hear anything from Dean because he tried to kill her. He's furious with Dean and just wants to be alone with his mom for a few minutes. So Sam gives them 5 minutes. In the other room, Sam asks if Dean was really going to kill her, and he says yes, without hesitation. He wishes he had, but he did hesitate. Sam starts to scold him, but Dean argues back that it was Crowley, and he had a chance to kill him. He should have taken it. But he also admits it would have sucked. He struggled with it. It wasn't just Crowley keeping him at bay. It was also Dean really not wanting to hurt Linda and kind of hoping that Crowley just left, you know? He didn't want to kill this woman. He admired her. He knows Kevin loves her. They detoured all this way to see her. He agrees this whole situation sucks, but he also sees the bigger picture. Or I guess I should say maybe he's kind of blinded by the bigger picture or the tiny sliver of that bigger picture that he currently has. He also admits it would have sucked. He would have hated himself for it, but what's one more nightmare? Just throw it on the pile of nightmares he already lives with. He's lived most of his life knowing exactly what it feels like to have lost his mother to a demon. He's not being cavalier with the loss and anger that he knows Kevin was facing there. But he points out to Sam that it seems a little too quiet in the other room. And when they go in to check on Kevin and Linda, they're both gone, but they left a note. Since Crowley has the tablet, Sam and Dean don't need Kevin anymore. So they're taking their chances on their own. Because when the Winchesters don't need you anymore, you tend to die bloody, right? Exactly like what Crowley said, and what Dean kind of believes of himself. Sam points out that Crowley still needs Kevin to read the tablet, and he's angry and shocked that Kevin would just abandon all the protection and go off on their own. He doesn't know what Kevin could have been thinking, but Dean does. He tells Sam that Kevin thinks that people he doesn't need anymore end up dead. Sam tries to tell Dean that that's not really true, and hopefully Dean doesn't believe that, but Dean has another flashback to Purgatory. and we get our first glimpse of what it looked like as Dean left Purgatory. He's internalized Crowley's words and shifted all of the blame for Cass not making it out onto himself. Because of course he's poison, of course he corrupts everything he touches, and of course everyone he doesn't need anymore dies bloody. And of course he abandoned Cass in Purgatory and failed to pull him out. Even though we know that's not the truth of what happened, this is just a major depression he's fighting in himself, because he couldn't take believing that Cass would have rather stayed in Purgatory than come home with him. Can you even imagine that kind of rejection? Because Dean can't. And isn't it great to know all of this while we're rewatching? Doesn't it add just a deliciously awful pall to the whole story? Because even if you had no idea what the future held when you first watched this unfold, it's impossible to rewatch it, knowing everything that's going to happen, and not see this as some high-grade witterer pining bullshit, right? This is what I mean when I say the entire way the story is told begins to change now, because their emotional and growth arcs had never been so wholly tied together the way they are now. It's impossible to just tell the story of Dean or to just tell the story of Castiel as if they were completely separate from one another. And I love that for us. But that is where this episode ends, on the horrified face of Cass looking up at Dean, calling his name, and leaving us to pine for the next episode, Season 8, Episode 3, Heartache, which takes a bit of a diversion from the horrors of Purgatory and lets Sam's flashbacks take the wheel. Unfortunately, he happened to have hit a dog. Pardon me while I gently bang my face on the keyboard about it. Anyway, we'll see Dean nearly get his heart ripped out in a very visceral way after having it ripped out emotionally in Purgatory. So there's that anyway. Until then, you can find me on Tumblr at MittensMorgul or at SPNGeorge. You can find me on Discord and Blue Sky as MittensMorgul, or you can email me at MittensMorgul@gmail.com. And I look forward to talking to everybody again real soon. And I didn't realize until like halfway through this episode that I'm kind of losing my voice again. How does this keep happening to me? I don't know, man. I walked through the rain for a very long distance yesterday, and it was very cold and very rainy, and then it snowed here today, and now it's sleeting, and I just can't win. I think I spent way too long cold and wet yesterday. Oh, man. Don't hike long distances in the rain. It sucks. Anyway. I'm warm and dry now. And done with this episode. So, have a good one, everyone.